other in a series of programs dealing with the problems and progress of resettlement. Today, the subject is farm tenancy.
Farm tenancy. Why should it be a problem? When did it start and how? The problems involved in the leasing of agricultural lands have never been studied by the average citizen. He has accepted them as part of our national life and forgotten them. In 1930, there were over 2,500,000 farmers, or 42% of all the farmers in this country, working on land which they did not own. Leasing their land on one basis or another, these farmers faced a life of insecurity and instability. Investigation shows that the average tenant changes his farm every 3 years. Knowing that he will move in a year, or at the most 3 years, the tenant has little incentive to fix up his house and barns, to plant fruit trees or flowers, to join a church, or even send his children to school. In many cases, when a man rents a farm, either on a cash or crop-sharing basis, he finds that the land has been cultivated for so many years that it is almost impossible for him to force another crop from the tired earth. This is particularly true of the great plantations of the Old South, where for years the fields were planted season after season with the same crop, cotton. In the years following the War of the Revolution, one of the great crops of the new nation was cotton, and the fields of white were then, as they are now, of vast interest to the visitor from the north.
Whoa, whoa, Patricia. Yeah, just let's rest here a moment. Yeah. Yeah, that's the sight I spoke of at dinner. Did you ever see anything prettier?
Beautiful. Cotton in blossom, as far as you can see.
Of course, we couldn't cultivate fields like this if we didn't have our slaves.
No, I suppose not.
Some Northerners don't like slavery, but our whole economic existence depends on it. Just think of the bales of cotton we ship up north into England.
It all has to be picked and baled by hand.
Yes. Of course, cotton wouldn't have the export value it has today if Eli Whitney hadn't invented the cotton gin.
That was about 20 years ago, wasn't it?
A little longer ago than that, in 1793 to be exact. Before that, we had to separate the lint from the seed by hand, and it took a long time.
Yes, I can imagine so.
Yes, sir. And I'll tell you something else. Right now, American cotton is beginning to be known all over the world. We can grow it better and cheaper than any other country. Here in the South, cotton is king.
Up to the time of the war between the states, cotton was certainly king in the southern states. And much of the cotton that was grown there was woven in the mills of the North. In 1814, a power loom was invented. And in 1828 came the ring frame. Both made the manufacture of cotton cloth easier and less expensive and created a greater demand. In 1861, the cruel misunderstanding that is now known as the Civil War interrupted the rule of King Cotton. By the time the war ended, slaves were free and the bankrupt South faced a labor problem. Who would work in the cotton fields? On some of the great plantations, the Negroes were still willing to remain for a price. But large numbers of the freed slaves flocked to the cities. Everywhere, the question of field help was a grave problem. Then one day, a conversation similar to the following took place.
Good evening, Mr. Henry. How are you? How's Mrs. Henry?
Well, we're all right, sir, considering...
Considering the times?
Yes, sir. You see, when I came back from the war, well, you know, we never had much of a place. But what we had was burned out, and the bank foreclosed on the land.
Yeah, too bad. Too bad.
It seems mighty difficult to get started again.
I can understand that. Mr. Henry, how would you like to work with me?
Work with you?
Yes. I could lease you as many acres of my place as you wished, and you can cultivate it with cotton.
Lease me? Oh, sir, I'll tell you, I couldn't lease anything. I'm penniless. Even if I had land, I couldn't work it. I've got a team of mules, but I don't own any tools. I haven't money enough to keep me going while the crop was started.
I didn't know things were as bad as that.
I think I'd better go to town and try to get a place clerking in a store.
But you always lived on a plantation. I know what we might do.
What's that, sir?
You take over part of my land and use my account at the store to buy the things you need. Tools and seed and food.
But how could I repay you?
We'll be partners. We'll share the profits of the crop. And out of your share of the profits, you can repay me for the things you have to buy at the store.
We'll share the profits of the crop. And I can repay you. Oh, that would be wonderful. Wonderful. Excuse me, sir. I've simply got to tell my wife about it.
In some such manner began the practice of sharecropping. The large landholder engaged a tenant farmer who lived through sharing the crop he produced with the owner of the land he cultivated. Many of these tenant farmers were impoverished white men who had once been slave owners. Some of them were Negroes. By 1870, farm tenancy had become widespread in the cotton states, and in 1880, 36% of the farmers were tenants on the land they worked. In the North, the mills hummed again, and once again, cotton was king. When the condition of a crop showed that a field was exhausted, new ground was plowed, and the first field was allowed to stand idle for a few seasons. If a farmer felt that his fields were thoroughly exhausted, there was always the opportunity of moving on.
Why, Sarah, come and sit down. How are you? What's the matter? You look so sad.
Oh, I'm discouraged, Sarah. Just downright discouraged.
Oh, aren't you feeling any better?
Oh, I'm all right. It's the cotton crop. Wasn't much good last year. Hardly paid our bills. Last spring we plowed over those new fields, but crop isn't much better.
Oh, the land's been worked too much. I've heard of that happening.
Yes, so we're going away, Sarah, to Texas.
Texas?
Mm-hmm.
Why, I'd never see you again if you went that far.
Oh, I don't want to go.
Oh, of course you don't, but... Well, if you and John will do better in Texas, then you ought to go there. Oh, and I didn't really mean that about not seeing you again. Why, I've heard that the land is so good in Texas, everybody gets rich.
I wonder if it's true.
Well, after all, if you have good, rich land, you're apt to get a bumper crop. And if you've got a bumper crop, you can't help but make money. You know, Mary, I'm really glad you're going. You can't tell. Maybe Tom and I'll be going, too.
The unscientific cultivation of the land brought poor crops. And poor crops sent many a man toward the West, where virgin fields were still available. From 1880 until 1900, the cotton belt expanded rapidly, and American cotton dominated the world market. This expansion did not stop with the coming of the 20th century. 10 million bales of cotton were grown in 1900, and the figure reached 17 million bales in 1931, almost double. Cotton still was king. But with the increase of production came the increase in the number of tenant farmers, and the plight of tenant farmers in the cotton belt was and is pitiful. If past practices and policies are to be followed, more than 100,000 farm families in the cotton belt of the Old South, that is, more than 500,000 persons, can look forward only to a bare existence, a living totally lacking in the petty comforts or in culture. The tenants realize the seriousness of this situation. So do many landlords. It has been the subject of many discussions, many addresses, such as the one made by R.K. Green, Rural Resettlement Chief of the Resettlement Administration, who spoke before a farmers' conference at Tuskegee Institute.
In 1880, only 36% of the farmers of the cotton states were tenants. But in 1930, the percentage had risen to 55.5%. Tenantry is still increasing among the white farmers more rapidly than among the colored. The tenant system is not a good agricultural system. Usually, neither tenant nor landlord makes money. A tenant whose occupancy of the land he farms is uncertain. He cannot be expected to build up the soil. An absentee landlord, devoting most of his time to business in town and only a little to his tenants, cannot supervise intelligently the use of his lands. A tenant begins a new crop year with high hopes, for hopes run high in spring. He plows and plants and hoes and gathers, and when he comes to pay up, he finds little or nothing left for himself and his family. He may find himself in debt, his hopes all to earth, and he moves from farm to farm, always looking for better conditions and rarely finding them. Behind him, he leaves debts and soil less fertile than when he tried to make it yield a living. But what can be done about it?
What can be done about it? Fortunately, something is being done. A typical case which has been helped is that of a young man named Jed Perkins. In the summer of 1933...
Jed?
I'm here, on the porch.
She's sleeping, Jed. Somehow she looks more peaceful, I think.
You think it's the end?
Well, I'm afraid so. Miss Pryor's sitting with her.
Good Lord, dying.
She's hardly more than 25.
Death ain't so unkind, Jed.
No, death ain't. It's life. She'll be better off dead than staying alive married to the like of me.
Oh, don't say that. You've been a good husband to her. You're a hard-working man.
Hard-working? What good has that done me, or her, or the two babies that died of the consumption, or the two youngsters that are still alive and sick?
Well, you've no cause to blame yourself.
Maybe not, but, well, somebody or something is to blame.
You've been a good husband and a good tenant.
Not a good tenant. Selling myself each year on a third and fourth basis. One-third of the cotton and one-fourth of the feed crops to the landlord for rent. Each spring I run into debt for seed and food. When the crop is in, I never have any money. Hardly enough food to last the winter. A good tenant.
Maybe things will be better.
It can't get much worse. Now that Ella's dying and the other two youngsters...
Miss Pryor says that they can go to a hospital and be made well.
Yes, they can go to the county hospital and I...
Yes?
And I can go on relief.
Oh, it don't seem fair, does it?
Fair. Don't seem as if there was any reason for a man to keep going on. I can work. I do work, but...
Jed.
What is it, Miss Pryor?
Is she?
I think she's passing. You better come in.
A depressing picture. A man willing to work and work hard, starting each new crop with high hopes, ending each season no better off than he was the year before. His wife and two of his children victims of tuberculosis. The depressed state of the nation forcing him to send his two surviving children to a county hospital, forcing him to go on relief. That was Jed Perkins before a resettlement administration field worker came to his aid. In the summer of 1935, Jed Perkins farmed again, the same 24 acres that he had farmed 2 years before. The difference was that the government, not the landlord, furnished him, provided him with a good work mule, a cow, farm implements, seed, feed, and what extra food he needed.
Jed. Oh, Jed.
Oh, it's you. Come in and rest a minute.
Well, me and Miss Pryor have been blackberrying, and oh, I didn't know a mouth could get so dry.
Well, let me draw you some water.
Oh, I'll get it. I know where things are.
Where's your ma?
She and the two youngsters went over to the community canning kitchen. Gee, it's swell to have ma living with me, to have the kids home from the hospital.
Oh, I know it is. How many cans did you put up?
Well, between us, me and ma must have done up nearly 500 cans of one thing or another.
That ought to last you all through the winter.
Will. This time next month, I'll have the barn filled with fodder for the animals. There's plenty of molasses in the house. I'll be able to sell some of it. And I'm aiming to sell about 2.5 bales of cotton, too.
You ought to be able to pay back some of your debt to the government.
$25 or $30 of it. You know, I was figuring, just as you came along, in 3 years, I'll have paid off all the money I owe the government. And you know what I'm going to do?
What?
I'm going to keep on following the farm plan me and the government people worked out. And I'll bet you that within a few years, I'll own my own land.
Now, that's something to look forward to.
Yes, it's just that. And that's something I never had before in all my life.
Something to look forward to. That's what the Resettlement Administration hopes to give thousands of tenant farmers in this nation. Not only in the Cotton Belt, but everywhere. The permanent resettlement program will not be limited to such desperate cases as that of Jed Perkins. It will aid farmers who are just managing to exist on substandard lands. It'll be of assistance to those who wish to buy their own land and so escape the cash or crop-sharing system. It will help young couples with farm backgrounds to start life on their own farms. In such a way will the small farmer gain his independence. In such a way will the man who is willing to work throw off the shackles of tenancy and become his own master.
You've just heard another broadcast setting forth the problems and progress of the Resettlement Administration. If you wish further details of this work, or need the administration's help, write to the Resettlement Administration, Washington, D.C., and they will notify you of the nearest regional office where you will be able to present your case. Thank you.